happens to you when you agree to be a Dharma teacher is that they ask you to give Dharma talks. So Pierce has been teaching us for years now in the Sangha by his presence and by his participation in just about every part of the life of the Sangha. But this is his first formal Dharma talk. So Pierce, much gratitude to you for stepping into this role.
I'm very happy to have this opportunity to talk about my experience of practice, and I'm grateful for the guidance of Bob and Valen, and for the opportunity also to practice with a group like this, a group of people who share my feeling about something that is of great value, this enterprise that we are engaged in. And I'm happy that my wife Susan is here. She is a fount of wisdom for me, Jewish wisdom, but also Zen wisdom, since I am sure that when you get down to the very bottom, wisdom is non-denominational. So I have been practicing here at Hank for 5 years, and I really feel that I found a home in Boundless Way, and particularly at Hank. I practiced for some 15 years in the Kwannon School of Zen, and before that for an even longer time in the Fourth Way tradition, which is a kind of eclectic mix of practices from different traditions. And I wasn't looking for a home when I first came here, when I wandered in off the street, as it were. I was just curious. And I was attracted, I must admit, by the name, the Henry David Thoreau Sangha. I had a t-shirt which said, "Only that day dawns to which we are awake," which is a quotation from one of Thoreau's books. And so I thought, Buddhism and Thoreau, yeah. But I was immediately struck by our sutra service, and in particular by the remembrances and the refuges. I think of them now as the two bookends of Buddhism, for reasons which may become apparent. In particular, the refuges. I had heard of, I knew what the three treasures were, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, but I had never actually taken the refuges in this formal way that we do it. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. And that really struck me as more than just words. It is an action. It is a deliberate taking refuge. And I felt that it really had significance. And it also made me realize that my conviction was, in fact, that there is no refuge. That there is no refuge from the suffering world. I mean, I sometimes think of myself as fighting a kind of rearguard action. I have a good life and I practice hard, but the outcome is assured. And it is not, in any sense, a victory. As Allen Ginsberg said when he was offered the Consolations of Buddhism by Jack Kerouac, it all ends in tears. And yet, on this first occasion at Hank, I thought, but what if there is a refuge? What if it's really true? And after all, this is the Buddha's promise. In response to the many abstruse questions that he was asked, he is reputed to have said, "I teach the end of suffering and nothing else." So I felt encouraged. But in case I was about to become overexcited or overjoyed, as it were, there are the remembrances. I am of the nature to grow old. This is not the sort of thing that I want to think about when I wake up in the morning or when I go to bed at night. These certainly are sobering. There is the last one, of course, which is a little different from the first four. But at any rate, this is different from the refuges. And yet I felt on this first occasion, because I was not familiar with the remembrances, had never said them like this in a formal way, and yet I felt, yes, this is something that is irrefutable. This is something solid. This is something that cannot be denied. And for that reason, maybe it is something upon which one can build a practice, a life. And I notice, of course, that in the last refuge, we say, my deeds are my closest companions, my deeds are the ground. And so it seems as though there is something solid here, even though on the face of it, it might be unpalatable. So then I was introduced to what we call our Zen bait and switch. And I immediately felt that its application to my own experience was undeniable. I mean, I had come to practice, to inner work, with the sense that I was going to be the new and improved me. I was going to, in some sense, transform my life. And of course, that didn't happen. And I also came to practice with the sense that perhaps inner work would compensate me for the disappointments that I had in my life. That somehow, I don't know, maybe I would be better at practice than I was at life. And I wasn't. I wasn't any worse. But I came to realize, particularly in relation to my Zen practice, that good, better, and best were beside the point here. That was not the issue. And that what was offered was not a new and improved life, or a different life, or a special state. What was offered was my whole life with all that that implies, with every element of it, with both joy and sorrow. And the question was, would I accept that? Was that what I wanted? So, two associations here that helped me, one sacred, one profane. Matthew's gospel, straight is the gate and narrow the way that leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. That was a line that had always puzzled me. I wondered why it said, and leadeth unto life. Because I had thought of practice as something that was, in some sense, opposed to life. I had thought that one flees the suffering world and takes refuge in practice. And I felt sure that, you know, if Matthew had intended to say internal life, he would have said so, and the translator would have found a way to render it. But in the light of Zen practice, I saw that it made sense. Leadeth unto life, because this is what Zen offers. It doesn't offer an immunity from suffering. It doesn't offer a special state. It offers me my life with its joys and its sorrows. It offers me an experience of my life, a full experience. The whole catastrophe, as somebody said, but that actually doesn't do justice to it, because it's not just a catastrophe. The other association, the profane association, the famous Pink Floyd song, Comfortably Numb, which, you know, back in the day in the 70s, when I first heard it, I didn't even pick up the title. I was just listening to the iconic guitar solo, which must be one of the most famous solos in all of rock music. But lately, in a more recent Pink Floyd retrospective, I heard the title and I looked at the lyrics. And the lyrics really spoke to me, especially the chorus, which goes something like, "When I was a child, I had a fleeting glimpse out of the corner of my eye." And, well, the body of the song is about a rock star who is rendering himself comfortably numb in order to perform the duties of a rock star. But the chorus is about his recollection of his childhood experience. And this spoke to me of my childhood experience. I remembered that there were moments of unity, moments of a sort of unmediated contact with the world, moments of wholeness, which didn't require any effort to maintain. It wasn't a practice. It was my life. And then the chorus goes on, "I turned to look and it was gone. I cannot put my finger on it now. The child is grown, the dream is gone. I have become comfortably numb." And the phrase "comfortably numb" really struck me. You know, it's a sort of an oxymoron, comfortably numb, because it ain't comfortable to be numb. Might not even be possible. And I have my strategies which defend me from living the complete life. They're pretty harmless strategies compared to the character Pink in the Pink Floyd movie The Wall, the rock star who is driven from pillar to post. I listen to late night baseball on the radio. I proofread my email. I reread my email and my text messages. I listen to snippets, or rather, I watch snippets of shows on YouTube that I pretend that I do not like. I am trying to screen out the world. But Zen practice teaches me that it's not necessary, it's not desirable. There is a tremendous amount of effort that goes into rendering oneself comfortable. And it's a great relief to be able to put that all down, to actually cease defending this little bubble of self, to let be, to let everything be. There's a real refuge there, actually. And so, it makes great sense also, because to try and flee from this human state is a futile enterprise. If I can borrow Dogen's rhetorical manner for a moment, what could there be for human beings but human experience? What else could there be? So, when I practice, I think of it as a refuge. And you know, I was raised Catholic, and for Catholics, the enemies are the world, the flesh, and the devil, but particularly the flesh, you know. And yet I feel that my practice is most solid when I can really get down into the experience of the body. That is the ultimate fact of my existence. That is the most solid thing. Human experience isn't possible without a body. And so, you know, skin bag, the last two lines of the grass-roofed hut. If you wish to know the undying person in the hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. And when I first heard it, I thought, that's odd, you know. How can we base our practice? How can I base my practice on something that is, in some sense, disintegrating before my very eyes, falling to pieces slowly? But I think the ancients are giving us a clue here, because I seem to hear them chuckling. The word skin bag is used in other readings in our sutras. I've come across it elsewhere. I'm not quite sure what is being translated here, but I feel that the ancients are chuckling here, that they're giving us a clue that this body is the vehicle of human experience, and that if I am really to come into possession of my own life, of my own experience, it will have to be through this skin bag. And so I love it when we read the grass-roofed hut together, because it reminds me that we're all in this together, as it were, the hut, the sangha, the enterprise of Zen, of this practice. And I feel very grateful to have found a home and a refuge in the sangha and in Boundless Way.
So we have our Dharma dialogue with Pierce. Will entertain all of our reactions and questions.